sometimes we're in danger of falling into the trap of that maybe just, you know, genetic gain. It's you know, you're achieving 0.5% a year or 1% a year gain, and it's just not sexy enough, or it's just not rapid enough. But we know it works. So there's no issue with engaging with these other technologies that might accelerate things. But we need to stick also to the basics, because, you know, you mentioned there earlier, like 5 years goes quickly, 10 years goes quickly. Think ultimately for us to actually get the maximum benefit for Ireland Inc., I do think we need to go and all ultimately all 2.4, 2.5 million animals need to be genotyped.
Hello, I'm Stuart Childs, and you're welcome to The Dairy Age, the Chagas Dairy Podcast. We're bringing you the latest information, insights and opinion to improve dairy farm performance. This week, as part of Chagas Breeding Week 2024, I'm talking with Sean Coughlin, CEO of the Irish Cattle Breeding Federation. ICBF has played a very significant role in the development of Irish dairy and beef breeding since it came into being in the late 90s. Many people in Ireland take it for granted at this stage, but it is an organisation that is the envy of many countries for the way it has engaged and integrated with all stakeholders in the breeding industry in Ireland to bring Irish breeding to where it is today. So for some perspective, I started by asking Sean to tell me how ICBF came about in the first place.
Throughout the 90s, there was quite a few initiatives put together and different reports trying to, I suppose, taking a lead from New Zealand in some ways to try and maybe set cattle breeding in Ireland on a different path. And ultimately that culminated in the setting up of ICBF in 1998 as a fledgling organization. And they hired Dr. Brian Wickham from New Zealand as the first CEO. And Brian had hosted a number of visits over the years through the late 70s and in the 80s and 90s from various groups in Ireland. So when the opportunity came up, they went and hired Brian. And look, in hindsight, it was an inspired choice. And I think that, I mean, the initial focus was on the dairy side. And through the 90s, I think there was a recognition that you know, We had been focused on production and you know, producing milk, which was obviously very critical in terms of output. But we had actually forgotten that there was a cost element and a fertility element maybe that hadn't been taken into account, and the indexes as they were back in through the 90s were only output based, so it was only milk volume really that was the only focus. So that was the first you know, drive to try and see, is there something we could do in relation to breeding for fertility? And there was a lot of skepticism, and in some quarters still exists today, that you could actually breed for fertility, or that you could breed, because it is a lowly heritable trait, unlike milk, which is, you know, it's very easy to breed and to get genetic improvement in milk. It's much harder to do that on the fertility side. So the initial stages were very much around getting that initial you know, fertility data, linking up with the Department of Agriculture, getting the calving data, linking in the milk recording side of things. And I mean, the interesting thing, even in terms of the things we take for granted now, when we started actually integrating the milk recording data and taking the data from the Department of Agriculture, both of which were being duplicated, because if you were milk recording at that time, you recorded calving details and birth notifications for the Department of Agriculture. Then on a separate form and a separate sheet of paper, you actually recorded all the calving details for the purposes of milk recording as the heifers came in. Now, when they actually did that, 60% of the calving dates were different between the Department of Agriculture system and the milk recording system. Okay, and some of them, and that wasn't down to any blackguarding or any deliberate you know, misrecording by farmers. That was just purely the fact that people were recording the same data on two different systems at two different times and didn't have a means of actually reconciling both. So even that, so if anybody that was doing pedigree registrations was actually recording the calving data up to five times in five different systems back in the early days. And again, you know, I think it's a good point that you raise. We sometimes take that for granted as to what it was like to actually be, you know, doing your calf registrations, doing milk recording, maybe doing some progeny testing, maybe pedigree, doing pedigree registrations. You were recording data on multiple different platforms, and inevitably it was going to lead to mistakes. So, and the thing I think the other thing I think is that the politics around setting up the organization, because again, when we started to include fertility into the evaluations, obviously, you know, some cows that would have been previously identified as being great cows were getting poor evaluations for fertility, and now suddenly they weren't being evaluated as being great cows anymore. And that was that was challenging as well for politically and for people to get their heads around how can my best cow be getting a poor EBI, for example, you know. And look, it took quite some time to work through that and for people to gain a bit of confidence in the system.
Yeah, and I suppose even it's interesting that you mentioned the parentage stuff there, like, because even up to now there's still kind of corrections and the genotyping is moving in the direction of correcting for that, like, but people often question why the best cow doesn't have a good EBI, and it mightn't always necessarily be explained by what you said there, that it was poor fertility or whatever. It can often be that the sire recording associated with it was actually wrong. So if one animal is wrong, the whole lot of the records are wrong. So it's actually interesting, because it's before my time now as well, like, in terms of that level of recording and the misrecording that was actually going on. And as you said, it wasn't intentional. It's just like at the time of when you do the first milk recording, sure, there was no real, it was a paper and pen exercise in terms of recording the data. Whereas now we click onto ICBF and we can get all the calving data that we have generated during the course of the year. So we do take that. I had even forgotten about that level of it, like, you know.
Yeah, no, look, it is no doubt, like, and look, and we've had very good cooperation. You know, you mentioned milk recording there with the likes of milk recording organizations and the AI companies and so on. And there's been really, really good work done there and building systems together that actually allow the different organizations to leverage off those. And that's one of the things I think, you know, that does in the early days in the setup, there's an awful lot of credit due to the AI milk recording organization, herd books, and so on, because one of the things in coming together into a central database is you do end up giving up a bit of autonomy, you know, that you have, because you can't just go in then and change a record willy nilly, because if it's an AI company changing a record, maybe it's affecting a milk recording organization, or it's affecting a herd book, or it's affecting some other piece of data. So the different organizations, they definitely had to come together and sacrifice a little bit of autonomy for the greater good. There was no question.
Yeah, so I suppose if we leave the setup behind, then I suppose we've progressed down through the years with changes to the indexes. And you mentioned it there that the original startup when we had the milk only and we were introducing the fertility piece to it, that it caused a bit of hassle. But I suppose every time there's a change to the index, there can be a little bit of angst around it, maybe, and people get upset, obviously, which is always the nature of the situation. But the reality of it is, the objective here is always to breed a better cow for Irish farmers. And I suppose what's really ringing true in that is probably the number of bulls that are from an Irish origin now that are on the active bull list, we'll say, are available through the AI stations, compared to what would have been available originally, which was nearly all the international bulls, really, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and there's a couple of points in relation to that, Stuart. One is I think the integration and the tight relationship that we've had with the Chagas on the dairy side, Chagas Moor Park from the early days, and the economic model that was built there allowed us to have a very robust basis on which to build the indexes, you know, and while we evaluate the traits, but the economic, the really how the EBI actually comes together and stitches together is driven by the economic values coming from that Moor Park economic model. And that has been extremely valuable in terms of, you know, initially we put in the fertility traits and then the health traits and the beef traits and all the various traits up along, and putting economic values on them. And that has been absolutely core to have that support and that tight relationship between ourselves and Chagas in that regard, because it avoids duplication in the work. We can't be talking about, wanting to remove duplication in terms of databases and then having us doing economic models and Chagas doing economic models. It only makes sense that we leverage what Chagas are doing in that regard. In terms of the bulls, I think that the critical thing there was was, you know, once we had the database set up and the EBI established, I think getting an Irish breeding program set up for Irish farming conditions was absolutely critical. And that really kicked off there in 2005, 2006. And again, you know, required a lot of cooperation. I mean, in fairness, Andrew Crommie would have driven a lot of that at that stage. And back in those days, I mean, of the top 75 bulls on the active bull list, you were looking at three or four bulls would have been Irish bred. You know, the vast majority were international, and move on 15 years later, and it's the opposite. The vast majority are Irish bred, and there's a handful that are coming in from abroad. And I think, you know, that's you know, that has been hugely valuable from an Ireland Inc. perspective. I do think it's important to have access to the foreign genetics all the time, and we've always kept ourselves open to bringing in those because there's always things happening and you can always learn, and we don't want to become too insular in that regard. But I think having a strong domestic breeding program is important for the domestic AI industry and for Irish farmers.
Yeah, no, you mentioned there a little while ago, we'll say that it obviously started with dairy in particular, but you've moved into the beef realm quite a lot in the last probably decade, I suppose. Maybe I'm up to
you're absolutely right. So really it was, you know, we had beef indexes probably from 2006, 2007 onwards, but really was 2012 when we established the main beef indexes, and then really was with the launch of BDGP in 2015 that it really took off. And then looking in the late teens of the 2000s there, we obviously launched the dairy beef index as well. And look, that's obviously you know, especially now at this stage when, you know, the dairy expansion is largely over, the dairy beef piece is absolutely critical. And you know, the work we've done on beef over the years has been crucial in terms of being able to have a good dairy beef index.
Yeah, and I suppose if we kind of look into the future but also look into the past, you do need to kind of be 5 years ahead of the game really in what you're doing. And in fairness to you, you have managed that. And as you said, I think it's credit to all parties and partners working together. And I think that's probably the thing that's the envy of a lot of other countries, is the relationship that is there between ICBF and all the organizations within the country that are all pushing effectively in the same direction. But so, like, you saw the need for the dairy beef ever before farmers were inclined to engage with it, I suppose. And you can argue that maybe the farmers aren't engaging with it because it isn't there for them to engage with as such. But like, you're putting in the research into stuff now that we're going to need in a couple of years' time. An example of that is probably the carbon index being brought in last year. So again, that's planning towards the future. Like, how do you manage to stay ahead all the time, if you know what I mean?
Look, I mean, it's again, as you mentioned, it's a combined effort. I mean, you know, a lot of the early research comes out of Chagas and Dunaberry's group in particular. That's where a lot of the early research comes in terms of trying to crystal ball and gaze forward. I mean, and you're absolutely right in terms of you know, needing to be ahead of it, because we, you know, if we want something in place for 2030, for example, we need to be thinking about it now. I mean, A plus B minus C came into the EBI in 2001. And it was 7 or 8 years later before a lot of the co-ops actually started to implement it. But once they actually did implement A plus B minus C, we had the cow that was actually fit for purpose to actually deliver it. And that's the same now in terms of the you know, you mentioned one there. Methane, for example, is one, you know, where again, we're trying to gather the data to predict forward and make sure that we can continue to produce high quality food in our dairy and beef herds, but do it with a lower methane footprint. Another example there, Stuart, would be just the health and disease. I mean, we do want to reduce the amount of antibiotics and the amount of drugs that are being used as much as possible, and we do know that it is possible to breed you know, more resilient animals, and you know, we need good data to do that, but it's possible to do that. So again, you know, whether that's, you know, we've in the last couple of years there introduced, for example, the the TB trait into the EBI, you know, and TB is a big issue. And we know that there is a genetic predisposition to resistance to TB. So we want to actually, we want to breed animals that if animals in a herd are exposed to TB, that they might not get it, you know, and that, so that's the type of thing. And anything that we can gather data for, Stuart, there's a good chance that we can actually breed for it, you know, that, that's the key thing. So, so good quality data, continues to be at the core of everything that we that that we do, and that's where farmers and the farm and the systems that farmers are putting in on their farms, it's critical that that data and that the flow of that data still flows to the central database, so we can actually leverage it for farmer benefit.
Yeah, so that's a, that was a point I was going to pick up on, actually, because we were only talking about it amongst our own advisors there in relation to the early milk recordings that are just taking place now on farms and how important that data is to be interpreted and the importance of recording the clinical cases of mastitis that are happening on farm, and you have systems in place for that. But I suppose we still see a low level of recording occurring there, so it's just to encourage people that this recording is important for themselves, but it's important for the industry as a whole as well. And I suppose, Sean, just to pick up on, you said it about fertility there, and there's a number of different traits, we'll say, that you have in the indexes, maybe that aren't, as you said, highly heritable in relation to the fertility. But when you give consideration to the, like, fertility can be, and you can correct me here now, like, on average is somewhere around 3.5 or 4% for heritability, I think it is.
Yeah, that's being generous even, Stuart. Yeah.
Yeah, so like these, how do you build a breeding program about around a trait that's so lowly heritable and yet actually get success out of it?
I think that the critical thing is that for those lowly heritable traits, once you have genetic variation in the population, you can do something on it, and we know that that's there. And then following on from that, I think the critical thing is that you have a volume of records. If you have a large enough population of records, you can filter out a lot of the noise and actually get back to where you're just isolating what is the genetic component of what we're seeing here, because we know on farms, the fertility of the animals, there's such a massive management effect on it, and it can be difficult to disentangle that from the genetic effect. But again, you know, you have a large enough data set, the statistical models that are there, and the power of the computers that are there can actually go and extract and manage to actually calculate what is the genetic variation, what are the good animals genetically and the poorer animals genetically.
Very good. Yeah, so it's important to record the data, just to remind people of that, because it's feeding into the future effectively.
Yeah, and it's important to record the data. And also, I would say, Stuart, is as farmers are more and more buying automated systems, whether they're in systems in the milking parlor, or they're buying collars, or they're buying tags with accelerometers in them. I think it is critical that in making those purchases, that farmers are dealing with people who are interested in actually sharing that with the national for the national good, because not every organization that's selling those products is in that space.
Yeah.
Not all the robot providers are allowing the data flowing. Not all the sensor providers are allowing the data to flow. And I think it's critical that farmers are making informed decisions in that regard, because more and more that is how the data is actually going to get recorded. It's not going to be either the farmer tapping it on an app or writing it out on paper. It's actually going to be recorded through sensors.
Yeah. So I suppose, just looking to the future then, Sean, like, as I said at the start or earlier there, you're in the position now, a surprisingly long 12 years or 12 or 14 years nearly, which took me by surprise. But and you mentioned 2030 there a while ago. Like, so if we were to leap forward and we were to do this podcast again in 2030, what are we going to be talking about in 2030, I suppose? What's on the agenda for ICBF, both beef and dairy? Like, obviously, it's a dairy podcast, but we have a beef element in it.
Yeah,
as well,
so look... I suppose, look, you know, at the moment we're in the midst of our first season at scale in terms of the national genotyping program, and we're going to do 600,000-700,000 calves through the national genotyping program. I'd certainly hope by 2030 that we'll be talking that all animals are in that scheme, and that it's just a routine, you know. And there's lots of there's lots of benefits to that will follow on in terms of whether that's, you know, surety of the genetic merit of animals, because we're going to want people to actually be buying animals based on the genetic merit. And if they're going to do that, they want to have surety of that what they're buying is what it says on the tin is actually what they're actually getting, you know. Also in terms of trying to maximize the actual genetic gain, you know, taking out the you know, to identify those outliers in the breeding program, to identify those exceptional animals, we want to take out the noise that comes with parentage errors. The reality is that on a lot of these, you know, farms that have expanded and so on, with the best will in the world, you know, you're going to have, you know, your sire errors are going to run at 15% and your dam errors are going to run at probably 4 or 5%. And again, it's not that there's any messing going on with the data. The reality is you come out in the morning and there's 4 or 5 calves in the pen and 4 or 5 cows. You're making a guess as to which is which. And if you never have one error. If you make one error, you're two errors. You know, that's part of the challenge, you know. And we do want to also, I mean, on the beef side, we want to keep improving the genetic merit of the stock bulls, whether that's in the suckler herd or on the dairy beef side. A lot of the progeny are still going to come from stock bulls, and we can't just be depending on AI. We need to have good bulls in AI, but we need to make sure that the gap between those AI bulls, those good AI bulls, and the stock bulls on the ground is minimized, so that farmers that are using the stock bulls are still getting good animals. And look, there's also a market point of difference. I mean, we are engaging in premium markets on both our dairy and beef side, and we want that market point of difference in terms of creating the premium brand around our genetics or carbon or enhanced traceability, so on and so forth. And then no doubt, it does all of that genotyping, for example, it does underpin a lot of the future R&D, both in terms of, you know, ourselves here in ICBF, in Chagisk, and even internationally as well, international collaborations. It makes us an attractive place for people to collaborate with on new research. And the most important thing we do is to actually make sure that we have that platform for doing the new research so that as new things come forward, we can adopt them quickly and we can react quickly. You know, and I think that agility to be able to have access to the data to do the new research, you know, is one of the most important things.
So ultimately, you see the genotyping being kind of a more wide scale even than it is, which in fairness it's a big lift in a short space of time in the 12 months with the NGP coming into place. And I suppose it's thrown up its own challenges in the early parts of it. And in fairness, you've responded very well to the challenges, I would say. And you're kind of over the worst of it nearly now, you'd imagine.
Yeah. No, look, and the challenge at farm level is, you know, you're dealing with farmers at their busiest time of the year. So if we're running at, you know, if we're running, for example, if we're doing 1 million animals and you're running at 99% success rate, right? 1% of the animals is 10,000 animals. That's still a lot of animals, you know? And if that's running, if every farmer has one of those, or, you know, every second farmer have one of those, that's still a little pebble in that farmer's shoe for in the spring season when they're tired and they're absolutely flat out and labor scarce and so on. So undoubtedly, there's a few wrinkles to be still ironed out on that. But yes, I mean, I think ultimately for us to actually get the maximum benefit for Ireland Inc., I do think we need to go and all ultimately all 2.4, 2.5 million animals need to be genotyped. And that's part of, in fairness, that is an element of the government's climate action plan to actually achieve that. You know, because I think in terms of those traits that are going to be really important into the future, in terms of health, in terms of carbon and so on, having the national herd genotyped is really going to help us to make progress in those areas.
And just, I suppose, again, crystal ball gazing, you mentioned about computer power there and the volume of records and so forth and how all the computers can make that work. If you combine the genotyping and probably enhancing computer power that you're probably dealing with there year on year, like, is this going to nearly go to an individual animal level as such, if in terms of breeding selections and Is it going to, is it like, I'll put it in context is, I suppose, I dropped in some of the NGP samples into the post office there myself the other day, and the lady behind the counter asked me, what's in those envelopes? Because there's a load of them coming in, she said. So I was telling her what it was about. I was like, it's DNA sample from the calves, and we're able to tell the parentage and able to tell the genetics of the animal. And she was just absolutely astounded by it. Like, she's just said, it's just phenomenal. Like, so the power of science that's actually in farming that people probably, again, I think nearly take for granted, to be honest. Like, but if we're like, it's only the tip of the iceberg, really, Sean, when we talk about starting the genotyping. Like,
yeah, no, look, and the number of, I mean, we're, you know, the volume, even the granularity of the data that we are getting in terms of the DNA samples, that's going to continue to become more and more granular as time goes on, and definitely we will be able to use that then in breeding advice and then mating bulls to cows and so on, and making sure that we're mating the right bulls to the right cows, and maximizing the genetic gain along the way.
And I suppose, just to wrap it up, I suppose the power of genetics, people can't underestimate it. Like, I mean, when I started working for Chagas nearly 20 years ago now, they used to be talking about protein 350 was kind of just the thing of the, it was a competition even to achieve it at one stage prior to me starting in the organization. And now it's average protein in the country is nearly higher than that. And the power of genetics to deliver more is quite significant. And that's just purely on the protein point of view. So, like, Donna has often suggested that there's nearly double, like, we could be talking about cows that are nearly doing 1,000 kilos of milk solids into the future, but we're just going to have to be able to feed them to do that. Like,
yeah, I think if you look at the genetic trends, for example, that have been achieved in chickens and in pigs, for example, we're still, and they're more closed loop, so it's easier to achieve the genetic gain. But I'm sure back in the 1960s and the 1970s, they thought that they were nearly at the top of those curves, and yet they've kept going, kept going and continue to achieve massive gains. And those gains are there to be achieved in dairy and beef breeding as well. I mean, I think sometimes we're in danger of falling into the trap of that maybe just, you know, genetic gain, it's, you know, you're achieving 0.5% a year or 1% a year gain, and it's just not sexy enough, or it's just not rapid enough. But we know it works. So there's no issue with engaging with these other technologies that might accelerate things. But we need to stick also to the basics, because, you know, you mentioned there earlier, like 5 years goes quickly, 10 years goes quickly. And if you're gaining 1% per year, and suddenly in 10 years, you're 10%, if you have 10% more production or 10% more profitability, that's a lot more, that's a lot of gain, and that we could go chasing our tail with these shiny new toys elsewhere and end up and realize that we actually forgot about the bread and butter stuff.
Yeah. So I suppose, To wrap it up, Sean, and you've actually kind of nearly summed it up in a way there. So, like, you're developing an index on the basis of a very strong, robust model. You're working very closely with Donna, and obviously, and his team, and Lawrence and so forth, in the modelling side of things, to make sure that the cow of the future is the cow that Irish farmers are going to need. And I suppose what I'd probably finish with is that it's important to remember what Donna says and what you spoke about it. And I always think of genetics exactly as how you spoke about it there now, but there is a counter angle to it that people need to be very conscious of as well. So Donna always says that permanent and cumulative, and which is exactly what you were highlighting there, but you make the wrong decision and it's also permanent and cumulative in the wrong direction. So your 0.5% gain every year that you're talking about can go backwards equally as well. So people need to be very careful in the decisions that they make, but they also need to have faith in the work that ICBF and Chagas are doing in terms of delivering the code that they do need into the future.
Absolutely, and that puts a lot of responsibility back on us and back on Chagas, and making sure that we're doing that ongoing validation, that at any point in time, if we're going offline, that we call it out and we say, look, we're hitting offline here. We need to backtrack, because as you say, the risk is that, you know, genomics and all the other technologies, they allow us to go faster. But if you're going faster in the wrong direction, it takes longer to come back if you are going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, so Sean, you mentioned about time passing quickly there a minute ago, and half an hour's after zipping by there. So we'll wrap it up with that. And I want to thank you very, very sincerely for coming on and joining me for this episode for Breeding Week
2024. My pleasure, Stuart. Thanks very much.
That's all for this week's episode of the Dairy Edge podcast. And my thanks to Sean Coughlin for joining me on this week's show. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe to the podcast. You can listen on Apple and Google Podcasts as well as Spotify. And for more information, go to the Chagas website at chagas.ie. I'm Stuart Childs, and join us next time for your Dairy Edge.